Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, Funny Girl, Broadway, and Naked Boy Singing. My guest this week is David Pevsner, the writer, actor, and erotic blogger. His book, Damn Shame, a memoir of desire, deviance, and show tunes, comes out in January. It's available to pre-order now, and catalogs his adventures on Broadway and on television as an escort and as a naked Tumblr star. It all starts with a kid dancing in secret to Barbra Streisand records. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder to check out my YouTube channel, where I post videos about queer pop culture history. I've got one coming this weekend about how Elvira became a gay icon and the queen of Halloween. And you can also head over to my Patreon to watch hours of bonus videos featuring stories of queer TV and film history. And check out my cute little newsletter, where I share sneak peeks of what I'm working on at mattbaume.com. Also, a big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris at patreon.com/mattbaume, and to everybody who's left a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's my conversation with David. Well, this week I'm speaking with writer, actor, erotic blogger David Pevsner. Thanks so much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
We used to have, when I was a little boy, 7 years old, 6 years old, we used to have one of those hi-fi stereos that had the TV in the center and then the stereo on each side. Mm-hmm. And it kind of smelled like it was burning as it warmed up.
Yeah.
And my parents had the Funny Girl original cast album. And mm-hmm. I not only played that thing over and over and over again, but then when nobody was home, I would sing with Barbara. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't just sing. My mom had this marble mortar and pestle. And I took the pestle, and that was my microphone. And mm-hmm. I would do a full out, you know, Barbra Streisand performance at the age of 6 or 7. That was the beginning of it for me. Seriously, mm-hmm. you know, wanting to be an actor and a singer and everything was totally about that album. So
this was like a little secret show that you were doing just for yourself?
Just for myself. In fact, one time my older sister came downstairs, and I was like, my eyes were closed and I was like flipping my hair back. I was really feeling it. And she comes down and like we met eyes and I just shut up. And she looked at me, it was like this little like staring contest for like 10 seconds. And then she just rolled her eyes and walked back upstairs. And I was like, I can't have that happen again. They cannot see me do this.
Was that something maybe that people had come to expect of you? Like, it sounds like you might've been a theatrical kid.
Well, I was. I mean, my big thing was I always make the joke that I watched 25 hours of TV a day because I watched a hell of a lot of TV, but I loved the commercials. And I would sit whenever we would go anywhere in the car. I always sat in the middle in the back seat. I had two sisters, and I would sing the commercial jingles like at the top of my lungs in the back seat. You know, it'd be like, you know, get Ajax, the blue dot cleanser, bah, 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 like at the top of my lungs. Mm-hmm. And you could see my sisters were just like looking out the window, rolling their eyes because they knew they couldn't shut me up. So I was kind of a theatrical little boy, but it was all about the commercials for me.
And Funny Girl. So I want to talk about that a little bit for folks who are not familiar. How do you describe,
who's
like, this
familiar?
Is the, I know, somehow.
Wait, what rock are you lying under?
what was the show and what did it mean to you?
Well, Funny Girl, you know, is the story of Fanny Brice and Barbra Streisand, you know, even though she did stuff before this is what kind of cemented her as a star, like A1 star. And she did both the original cast on Broadway. She did it in London, and then she did the film in 1968, I believe. And there was just something, you know, like you wonder why when you're like a little burgeoning gay boy inside and you don't quite understand that yet, mm-hmm. you know, there's something different about you. And every so often you run into, like I said, I watched a ton of television and I loved to sing and everything, but there was something about her that like, I subconsciously kicked into. It was this like expression of self. You know, she wasn't your typical beauty, and she was definitely more talented than anybody who had been around for however long. But there was a confidence there, and there was a cockiness despite her looks. And I say that with quotes. There was just something about her that was shamelessly who she was. And I think that, you know, we little gay boys kind of kick into things like that, you know, the Lizas and the Judys and the, you know, that kind of entertainer. For me, it was always Barbara, always.
Hmm. Yeah, I was curious, like, what a six-year-old would think of, like, Funny Girl, because it's such a adult story. I guess, like,
yeah, but I was,
or maybe not.
I can't honestly say that I understood everything I was singing. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, there's a song called The Music That Makes Me Dance. You know, his is the only music that makes me dance. Well, I didn't know what that was, but I could hear the need in her voice and I could hear the sorrow in her voice. And I just wanted to kind of ape that while she sang. I didn't know how to sing. Like, I'm sure, like, I was ripping my throat out. There was just something about it. It was coming from such a gut place. And I was always an emotional little kid. And I was always really, you know, smart and friendly. And you know, it just kicked into things. But insecure, you know, and small. And I had two older sisters that I, you know, loved but picked on me. Hmm. And at school, I got picked on a lot because I didn't play sports. And I was kind of small. And, you know, fag came at me, you know, from as early as I can remember. So it was just kind of like that confidence that you felt in her voice to me was, I think, probably what has kept me connected to her pretty much my whole life.
Yeah. I mean, she is, even if you don't understand the story, even if you didn't speak English, you can hear like how passionate she is as a singer.
And that voice, you just didn't hear a voice like that. You didn't hear somebody put so much emotion and find so many colors, even on Broadway. I mean, it was just such an elastic voice, you know. The Funny Girl album, it's one of the best albums. Her performance on that, it's just one of the best albums you'll ever invest in.
And for all of her, as emotional as she is, there's, I guess, I like you were saying, a confidence. Like, somebody doesn't sing like that if they're not confident. I mean, there's just a tremendous strength and control of her voice. So she might be lamenting the circumstances of her character, but there's a real power behind the voice that's telling the story.
Yeah. And the confidence that she had to do things that nobody else was doing, like, you know, you can't flip your voice that way. And she'd be like, I don't care. It's what I'm feeling in the moment. That's what I'm going to do. And I kind of learned that. I kind of picked up on that. There were things growing up, I think, that colored me without me really knowing who I was going to be as a performer and an actor, like, you know, listening to Barbra Streisand sing or laughing at Bugs Bunny and his sense of humor, Lucy, you know, I Love Lucy. Those are the things I watched incessantly as a kid, and they couldn't help but help me to understand comedy and connection. And you know, I like to think that I know what's funny, you know, both in what I do and what I see. And Lucy and Bugs Bunny, you know, they did it for me as well.
Yeah. Well, so tell me about where that, I guess that sort of theatrical bug took you. Like, at what point did you start performing more, you know, deliberately than just singing along when no one's looking?
It's funny. I talk about all of this in the book because it's, you know, it's not a theatrical biography by any stretch, but it kind of taps into things that a lot of people feel. You know, I was a really, really smart kid, but I could also see how being smart could get you beaten up. So I started to put on plays, and I could never get the boys to be in them with me, only the girls.
How old were you?
Oh, God. I think I started in second grade. I started writing plays and putting them on and asking all the girls to be in them with me.
Do you remember what they were about?
Well, actually, one of them was a musical based on the song Windy. Do you remember the song Windy?
Not really.
Who was peeking out from under the
stairs? Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, that's a – well – not that I ever understood what that song meant or what was actually happening in it, but I wrote what I believed it was, and I got a girl named Wendy to play her. So I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. And it was just this whole drama based on this song. You know, I think the teachers really liked it a lot. The kids sometimes, you know, when they would say, like, David has a play today, sometimes you could hear kids going, oh, shit, you know. But it was this thing that I couldn't be shamed. I couldn't be humiliated. It was just something I loved doing. And there were people who loved doing it with me. Yeah, that's kind of where it all started. That and the commercials in the backseat of the car.
Mm-hmm. Where did those plays take you? Like, it seems like you certainly got a reputation. So, by the time you were in elementary school, was it just like, okay, he's the drama kid?
I was kind of the drama kid until I want to say like sixth or seventh grade, because, as you know, it didn't stop guys from, you know, beating me up and calling me faggot. And, like, you know, wrestling class was, you know, we would do wrestling in gym. That was the absolute worst, because that's where they could, like, you know, physically take out on me what they were either thinking or saying. And after a while, I just stopped writing the plays. I just stopped doing them. I was like, I can't. You know, it's vulnerable. Even if you're doing like a silly musical based on Windy, you're still making yourself really vulnerable. And as much as I love to hear people clap and laugh and smile and everything, I hated even more that they were thinking that I was just a big fag. So I stopped. And it wasn't until high school that I started doing theater again.
What changed in high school?
Well, first of all, you get away, you find your crowd a little bit more. You know, like I kind of fell in with the theater kids, and everybody was all the guys who beat me up were now hanging out on Mulford Street and smoking cigarettes. And I could like walk past them and not deal with them. Mm-hmm. And gym class was even different. You know, you were a little more like, oh, well, swimming. OK, I can do that, even though I hated it. But it didn't feel as invasive as grammar school gym class was. You know, and I started doing plays. I mean, I did a musical, the very first thing, you know, got one of the leads. And from there, it was like 4 years of I'm a thespian.
What was the musical?
It was King and I.
Oh, okay.
And I played Prince Chula Longcorn. Because, of course, there were no Asians at all. You couldn't do that now.
Sure. Where was this?
This was at Niles East High School in Skokie, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. But it was my first time in front of a big audience. And it was, I just remember there's a song in the show called The March of the Siamese Children. Mm-hmm. And it's when all the kids of the king make their entrance. And it was staged that you're in the wings of the stage, and you march to the center to the music. And then you, on your cue, you turn forward, and all of a sudden you're center stage looking right at the audience. And I remembered when I turned, I thought my legs were going to fall out from under me because I'd never faced a big audience before. And that was my first bout with stage fright. But I got through it. And, you know, over the years, stage fright comes and goes. But that was my first moment in front of an audience. And I kind of loved it. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do.
Was that what was going through your head? Like once the stage fright, I don't know, like if it dissipated or maybe that just replaced it?
It did dissipate, but it was more about the fact that like you would say something funny and people would laugh, or you would sing a song and then they would clap, or you would look at another actor and you would say something and then they would react to you and then you'd react back and you're like, well, this is how life is supposed to be. I can live life the way I want to right up here. And it just became something that felt very organic to me, scary sometimes, but organic and in a place where once you're in a show and once the show is running, nobody can touch you. The director's not going to run up on stage and say, you can't do that. The kids aren't going to come up on stage and say, you faggot. They can't do it. You know, you are totally safe up there, although you put yourself into the danger zone when you put yourself into the moment.
Well, in what way did you feel like you were in some sort of danger? Like what was that danger?
Well, it's not really a danger. Like when you're in the theater, you know, every night is different. And so you start at the beginning and you don't plan, you just go with it. And it feels kind of dangerous in a really good way because you're in front of a zillion people, you know. I can't put into words. You just let it go, you know. You connect and you see what happens. That's why theater is so great, because things can happen on a, you know, in live theater that you didn't expect, and you kind of roll with them. And, you know, it's thrilling. It's thrilling to be in a live show. Never has stopped for me being thrilling.
It sounds like one of the big comforts there was that there was sort of a framework for what's going to happen. Here's the
exactly.
lines and here's the characters. We have some level of predictability here. And
exactly.
then the excitement, maybe if it's not danger, then the risk is that there's always the possibility, because it's live and there's a lot of people watching, something could go wrong, or we might discover something. Something could go right.
That's exactly that it. There's so many – you know, the best is when you have a happy accident. Mm-hmm. And somebody forgets their line, and so you kind of have to – you know, make the moment work, and it ends up being funny or exciting or, you know, or energizing. There's just, I mean, I've done a lot of TV and I've done film and stuff, but theater to me is really where it's at, because there is no taking it back. And you do it, and then you get a chance the next night to build upon what you did. And over the years, my technique has changed as a theater actor, because I used to be a bit of a planner, you know, like this is how I'm going to feel at this moment. And it wasn't satisfying. When I kind of let go of all that and just said, okay, just start, get out there, do your stuff, connect with the other actor, connect with the audience, whatever, and just let it go. And it's just exciting. I don't know if anybody who's never been in a play will understand what I'm talking about, but it's like in any conversation, when you have a great conversation with somebody and you're kind of riffing off each other, it's as thrilling as that, you know?
Are there moments that stick in your mind as either happy accidents or disasters, like unexpected things that happened to you on stage?
Well, I mean, forgetting lines is kind of bracing, but if you really mm-hmm. stay connected, something comes to you, whether it's the actual lines or whatever, and you kind of get through, and then it's heightened your awareness. Like all of a sudden you're like hyper aware and really connecting, you know? I mean, it can be horrible to forget lines, but it also can be really exciting. The worst thing I've ever seen was just didn't happen to me, but I was in the play, The Prime of Miss Jean Brody in high school, and there were two casts. So I was watching the other cast do the scene, and they were doing the scene in a locker room. And one of the girls grabbed a bag, like a gym bag off the set, and it hooked onto this hook and the whole set came down.
Oh, yikes.
The whole set came down. I mean, just like forward, didn't hit anybody. But the audience is like, like this, and it's totally quiet because they're seeing if anybody was hurt. And then one of the girls, this little slip of a girl, turns to her and she goes, "You're so clumsy." And the audience just lost it. But that's the kind of thing. It's like, it didn't matter how good or bad the play was. That's what they're going to remember from, "Oh, I saw that performance." Yeah. Mm-hmm. The audiences love that kind of stuff. And it's so you kind of have to give into it. You can't be like, "Shit, why did that happen?" Mm-hmm. No, you know, it was a great audience moment. And nobody got hurt.
Yeah. Even better.
Even better.
Where did you go from there? Like you said, high school, that sounds like from your first show, you had a lead role.
Yeah.
What were your aspirations, or like, what kind of drama did you like doing?
Well, you know, we did all kinds of shows, and we had a very good department. And my high school drama teacher, Jerry Prophet, if you're listening, Jerry, hi, was great. And he wouldn't do the typical high school shows. Like we would do things like the musical version of Two Gentlemen of Verona, or John Guare's House of Blue Leaves. I mean, we did really different, sophisticated stuff for a high school. Mm-hmm. And I loved all of it, but it was always the musicals for me, you know? And I was a ham, you know? I had a big old musical comedy face and a big old musical comedy voice. I wasn't the best singer. I'm still not the best singer in the world. But I have a lot of love for the art of it. Mm-hmm. And it was great to kind of express that. So, you know, I had 4 years of doing like five shows a year, and it was,
wow, that is a lot.
We did a bunch of stuff. We had like a musical, a straight play, a comedy, an improv show. I mean, it was all, you know, kind of juggled for each year.
And it sounds like it's really setting you up for a career as a performer.
Yes, it really, really did. And, you know, my folks were not thrilled when I told them that's what I wanted to do, because they were like, "You're going to be a doctor or you're going to be a lawyer." And I was like, "No, I'm not." But eventually they came to grips with it, because I went for a year at the University of Michigan, where I kind of juggled theater and other stuff, you know, classes that could lead me to a more mainstream career. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't happy. I was actually miserable. I had gotten into Carnegie Mellon University at the same time, and they were like, "No, we're not going to send you to an all theater school to start." Mm-hmm. And then after the year at Michigan, which was hell in so many directions, I was finally allowed to go to Carnegie the next year. And that's when I kind of put the nose to the grindstone and knew this is what I was going to do, despite Carnegie like trying to knock the art out of many of us. Because I talk about this in the book a lot. If you were effeminate, if you were a boy who was effeminate, or you were a girl who had a little extra weight on her, they were merciless. They're like, "You're never going to work." And they kicked out a lot of kids, a lot
like
of
staff.
Boys for being, yep, the kids got kicked out for if they were too effeminate or if they couldn't lose weight. It was awful. And so I went 4 years like with waiting for the shoe to drop, you know, and it was a tough, I made it through the 4 years. But I left it with a lot of insecurity, which is just a great way to start a career, you know?
Yeah, especially as an actor. I was going to say that it seems like you might have had a better social experience going to a school with more of an arts focus, but it sounds like they were pretty the school itself was pretty focused on giving you all kinds of different complexes.
Well, there were a lot of messages they were sending that were just not good for us, especially when you were like, you know, I was a school kid. I was like, I'm a student, you know, I'll pick up everything. And if it's a teacher who has something to say, I have such respect for teachers. But when they're doing this very personal bullshit and you don't quite, you're not the type of person who goes, you know, well, fuck you. I'm going to do what I want. Mm. You know, I wasn't that kind of person. So I kind of took it in, and it was just part of my life at Carnegie. You know, I mean, there was great stuff. I met some great people there. I'm friends to this day. And it didn't stray me from wanting to be an actor, you know. Despite Carnegie, I continued.
Mm-hmm. You know. To where? Where'd you go after that?
I went to New York.
Okay.
I moved my ass to New York City and started doing, I did a lot of regional theater, you know, where you go and you would audition for stuff and then go out of town for 2 or 3 months at a time. You know, some towns that were like, you know, bumfuck, and some of them were like, you know, Denver. Like, it was a great life because you would go and you would do a show that you really loved doing, and you'd work with wonderful actors, and you'd live in whatever housing they gave you, and you'd do that for 2 or 3 months and then go back to New York, audition, and try and get more stuff. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of that back and forth, waiting tables in between, until I did A Fiddler on Broadway in 1989-90. Yeah, I did a couple of national tours of musicals, and that led me to Fiddler. And working in New York on Broadway, which was great, you know, a great experience.
What were your, like, when you got that role, do you remember what happened when you got it, like receiving the news? And what were your expectations for being in a Broadway show?
Well, I had just done a tour with the same production company of South mm-hmm. Pacific with Robert Goulet, my God. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of, I was on their radar. It was the same casting director. So when I got the Broadway show, I knew there was going to be a tour first. So mm-hmm. just like the other tour. So we toured for like a year plus with Fiddler. So I didn't think really about Broadway so much because I was too busy being on the road doing the show. But when we actually got to New York, it was pretty exciting because Jerome Robbins, who was the original choreographer director of that show, and, you know, a genius and a tyrant, came to help us open. You know, we had a couple of rehearsals with him, and that was just so exciting to work with this legend, you know, to get that mm-hmm. chance. And then, yeah, we ran for 10. It was great being on Broadway. I mean, it had its issues with certain people within the show, but the show is, have you ever seen Fiddler?
Yeah.
It's just brilliant. It's just the best. It's a great show. I'm so proud that we were doing it on Broadway, and you know, it was nice to make Broadway money and kind of relax in New York for a while. It was good.
Yeah, were you out at that point as a performer?
Oh, I was the minute I set foot in New York City, I was out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gosh, but also a difficult time to be there and to be like joining a gay community.
Oh my God. Well, you know, it's from I moved to New York in 1982, and that's, you know, right about where shit was hitting the fan. And I kind of knew not to engage the way I kind of wanted to sexually. Mm-hmm. And it's because of that early awareness for me that I'm still here. it was very scary. I mean, it was like because in the early days, they just didn't know exactly how it was transmitted. And right. You would see people like I was out with some friends. Like I had a friend, in New York City, who was kind of in the Broadway world. And he invited me out one night with all these Broadway dancer guys. And it was really fun because I was, you know, kind of really early, like 82 or 83. And there was one guy who was coughing all night long. He was coughing all night. And I said, what's going on? He goes, oh, I started swimming a couple weeks ago. And I think it's just the chlorine is getting to me. Okay. So about 2 weeks later, I'm talking to my friend who invited me and he said, remember that guy who was coughing? I said, yeah. He goes, he's dead. I was like, what? He goes, yeah, it's this thing that's going around. And And I think that's what he had. And that's the very first person I knew who died, one of many over the years. And this was in 83.
Yeah, so right at the start.
So it was kind of like very bracing at the very beginning. And it put the, you know, for me and for many, it put the fear of God into sex, you know. And so it kind of retarded my sex life for many, many years. Not that I didn't have sex, of course I did, but with the walls
right,
you know.
Yeah, and I imagine there was also like a lot of organizing and, you know, to be coming into the community at that time when there's such a, like, I don't know, priority for everybody. How, I don't know, like, was that just like all anyone was talking about, or were there actions, and how involved were you?
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of ACT UP, which actually, so they would have meetings, and the more I kind of lost people or heard people getting sick, the more I was like, well, what can I do? You know, so I'd go to ACT UP meetings, and I was not any kind of like a revolutionary activist-y kind of guy. I would go and I would listen, and, you know, listen to the anger and listen to the frustration, because of course, you know, Mayor Koch wasn't doing anything, and Ronald Reagan wasn't doing anything. And there was tremendous frustration about the fact that no one was helping the fags. You know, it was like, oh, it's only them. We're not going to pay attention to this. And so there was a lot of anger, but I was still this like Midwest, I'm going to be an actor guy. So I just didn't kick into the anger of it all. But I mean, I went to some, you know, I helped out where I could. But I saw firsthand what it was doing to people. And, you know, you just think something like that, oh, that's not going to happen to me. I'm Midwest. I'm, you know, no, of course it did. It got closer and closer and closer. And it was just a parade of people where you'd be like, oh, no, not him. No, not him.
Yeah. Wow. I know that the theater community was particularly active in terms of like organizing and fundraising. And
Broadway Cares. And I did a lot of benefits for them when I was working in off-Broadway and Broadway. And I did a show called When Pigs Fly, which was an off-Broadway show, really fun show. And it was all based around these incredible costumes by this guy named Howard Crabtree. And Howard had had a couple of shows off Broadway before, but this was his, you know, this was the brilliance. I mean, it was his penultimate, his ultimate show. But he had gotten ill while we were in rehearsal and everything. He had been sick with AIDS. I don't know how long he had been ill. But the only time I ever met him was when I went to the costume fitting at his farm in, was it New Paltz? It's somewhere in Connecticut. And he was in bed, and the idea was we were going to do a costume parade where we put on the costumes, and he would give notes to his partner, Danny, who was, you know, sitting off to the side, but he couldn't get out of bed. So they brought me in because everybody else in the show had worked with Howard before, and I had not. So I walked in and kind of like lifted himself up, and he reached his arms. Oh, my God, I get emotional thinking about this every time. He gave me a hug, and he said, "Welcome to the family." And we proceeded to put on the costumes, and he gave notes, but he didn't make it to opening night. You know, he passed before that. And they're actually doing a documentary called Ghost Lights. I don't know if you've heard of this.
No.
But it's going to be, I think, an 8-part documentary about all the Broadway people that were lost to AIDS and all the talent that, you know, we've been deprived of because of it. And I actually did an interview for it about Howard. But yeah, you think about what we lost on Broadway people.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
How long did you stay in New York?
I was in New York for 16 years. I was there from 82 to 98. Okay. And at the tail end, I was doing a lot of kind of high profile off-Broadway gay theater. Like When Pigs Fly, I did a show called Party, which was like one of the first naked plays.
What was that scene like? What was off-Broadway gay theater of the 90s?
Oh, it was so much fun. Because it just seemed like people were really starting to spread their wings when it came to telling gay stories and telling them, like, the two shows that I did were like really high profile. They were done at the Douglas Fairbanks Theater, and, you know, New York Times reviewed them, and they got a lot of attention, and all the stars came to see them. I mean, we were telling gay stories, and people were actually coming beyond just the gay audience to watch and laugh and listen and say, hey, you know, gays are funny too. Gays are, you know, that we all kind of have the same. I mean, I think the shows that I did were very universal in a certain way, very relatable. Hmm. And it was a ball. It was just such a ball to be a part of that and to go to the theater every night and hear people laugh, you know, and it was a magical time. And When Pigs Fly is hands down the best show I've ever been in, except for maybe when I, you know, doing Broadway Bears.
Sure.
For Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, because those shows are insane.
Sure, yeah.
How brilliant.
Can you describe what that is for folks who aren't familiar?
Broadway Bears is a fundraiser that started, I want to say, like 1988 or something like that. And it was it's to raise money for Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS. And it started as a strip show at a bar called Splash in New York. It was, you know, just a regular gay bar, although they did have showers on the stage. But they would get some dancers together to do strips, and I think they charged the entry fee, and then the guys would stand in the bars and get dollar bills, and all of that money would go to Broadway Cares. And every year it got bigger and bigger. It moved out of Splash and then started playing venues like Roseland. And where did I do? I've done three of them. I did Roseland. I can't remember where else they do it, but it gets bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And I can't even tell you how many millions and millions and millions of dollars it has raised for Broadway Cares, because it's Jerry Mitchell, the choreographer, director, started it. And because he was actually in, it's kind of a fun story. He was in the Will Rogers Follies, and one of his numbers as a dancer was in a loincloth dancing on a drum. And that's kind of what spurred him on to go, hey, people like this. I'm going to do this in a bar and raise money. And that's how it started, is my understanding.
That's good marketing.
A great marketing, yeah.
Wow.
And every year they just do a brilliant job, from the marketing of it to the choreography to the people they get to do it. It's just gotten bigger and bigger. And I mean, I haven't seen it for a bunch of years because I've been out of New York, but I was just so proud to have been a part of that and to help raise so much money.
What got you out of New York?
Originally, you know how I talked about watching a ton of TV. TV was kind of my dream in a way, even though I had only really done theater. So I had written some songs for a show called Naked Boys Singing. And I had three songs in that show, and it had opened in Los Angeles. And besides feeling like, I think I'm done with New York for now, just because my shoulders were up to my ears every day with tension. Like the tension of the city just built up. And I thought, let me go out to LA for a little bit. Maybe I'll start auditioning for some TV stuff. I'll see how Naked Boys is doing, and maybe I can turn that into something. And I went out for 3 months and ended up staying. How many years is it now? 22 years.
What was your initial impression of Los Angeles? Because I feel like when someone goes, they know pretty quickly whether they belong there or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say like LA people are really phony and New York people are really, you know, they tell it how it is. And I found I didn't want everybody to tell me how it is all the time, you know? So in LA, it was kind of nice. Sometimes people would be like, have a nice day. And I'd be like, oh, thank you. But I loved the weather. I am not, even though I lived in Chicago. I went to school at Michigan and Pittsburgh, lived in New York for 16 years. If I never see another snowfall, it'd be fine with me. I hate snow, hate it. So the weather was like the siren song for me here in Los Angeles. And I started to pursue TV and film. And then I also started writing more because Naked Boys was doing really well. It ended up moving to New York and running for 20 something years. There was something about the lifestyle out here that appealed to me, even though I'm an urban, like I'm a New Yorker. I am a New Yorker, but it just got too much for me after a while. And I liked more space. I liked more relaxation. And I probably went a little too far sometimes. I would go to the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf in my neighborhood and sit outside, take off my shirt, I had written a screenplay that I was trying to get made. So I'd make phone calls. I was like one of those people sitting out, you know, with their computers in front of them doing business and living kind of a bohemian life. But I was never a bohemian type. So it was kind of fun to be that for a while.
What was, and it changed was me. There like a, I don't know, the, did the TV gigs happen? Like, did you have like, you know, day jobs to keep you, you know, just to pay the bills?
Yeah, I was all over the place. I mean, I would do a little TV thing. I also, I mean, we kind of skirted over this, and it's, you know, very present in my book. I was a male escort in New York while I was doing those off-Broadway shows. So I was living this crazy double life.
Wow. Yeah. Was that something that you felt like you had to keep secret, or did people just know?
My friends knew, and I did feel like I had to keep it secret. I got involved in a relationship with someone who I admitted it to, and I quit for him and didn't do it again in New York. And the relationship was just tumultuous and awful anyway. That's all in the book too. And believe me, anybody who's had a bad relationship, there's a lot to relate to in this one. You know, judgment of, you know, how you live your life, and just a lot of crap that made me not want to have another relationship pretty much to this day. Not really, but for a long time. And then coming to LA, not only did I do the LA cast of When Pigs Fly and continue to write stuff, would do TV stuff, then I didn't want to wait tables again. So I became an escort again and kind of did it on my own because I worked for a service in New York. And I just started juggling all this stuff because there was also a sexual side of me. And maybe it was because of AIDS that it got kind of retarded, that I needed to explore. And as a little boy, I needed to explore. I was so ashamed of my body. I was so skinny. I couldn't even like sit in a bathing suit at a pool without just, you know, wanting to kill myself from shame. So it was something.
But then
body shame was always something.
You're so involved in a show called Naked Boys Singing.
Yeah, well, but that's because it always, you know, I wrote fantasy songs about being a porn star, for instance, and that's one of the songs. When I did kind of build myself up back in the Fiddler days, I started to be a little bit more promiscuous, and I started to put myself out there. I started having more confidence, and I actually became a naked maid, and I wrote a song about it. And then it got into Naked Boys Singing, which has been running for 20 years. So I've never been one. Once I dove into the erotic and the physical and nudity, et cetera, it's become a big part of my life. It's something I explore because a lot of people don't want to explore it. A lot of people don't want to talk about it and feel great shame about it. And I'm determined to have people be a little more comfortable with it, to not judge people because of how they put themselves out there sexually. I'm sick of it. It's been all these years writing the songs and being an escort and a naked maid and stripping for Broadway Cares, even, you know, my erotic blogs that I have. It's all a part of me getting comfortable with my own sexuality and nudity because I want other people to as well. I'm tired of the muck that people attach to things like nudity and sexuality.
You know? Do you remember when you first noticed that something had changed, that you were more comfortable taking your clothes off?
That's a very good question. I think, well, it was definitely when, after I had built myself up more. You know, you go on the road to do a show and you have a lot of time. So I spent a lot of time in the gym. And I think I remember a Halloween where everybody was dressing. We were in New Orleans and we were all dressing up to go out on the town on our night off. And everybody was renting costumes like, you know, Little Bo Peep and, oh, I'm a beef eater. Well, I didn't want to do that. I was always attracted to leather. So I went to this shop and bought all this leather, and I wasn't shirtless, but I was wearing pants with, you know, tight pants with rips and a leather tank top and an armband and, you know, motorcycle boots. And I got myself together and I was kind of like this nice Jewish kid, you know, even doing the shows, I was like a nice Jewish boy. And I dressed up kind of in my fantasy and I walked down, we were in a hotel, took the elevator down. Doors open, I walk out, and literally all of a sudden you could hear not a peep. All of a sudden everybody was looking at me. And it wasn't like, ooh, look at him. It was like, whoa, look at that. And I kind of like that, that kind of attention, you know, being a sexual attention rather than like, oh, look at you. You're dressed like a clown.
Sure.
You know, and I think that that was one of the first moments where I felt, okay, I'm on the right track with what I want to change about myself. I want to feel comfortable with it. I want to feel sexy. I want to feel dangerous. I want to feel like, and I put this in quotes, like a man, even though that's how I felt back then. Now, my definition of what a man is, you know, it's all over the place because I have learned. But back then, that's what it was to me.
Yeah. So tell me about like being an escort first in New York and then in LA. That's, you know, different a bit from, I don't know, appearing on stage or, you know, the stripping that you're doing. That's much more of a, like a one-on-one generally, one-on-one kind of thing. So I'm curious, like how, if that felt different to you.
It was acting in a way.
Huh.
I mean, it wasn't, in fact, it was very intimate acting sometimes. But what it taught me for somebody, I was very kind of body Nazi-ist in a way, you know, like if you didn't have a great body, I wouldn't date you back then. Back then. This is all back then. This is not now. Which a lot of guys were, certainly. I had to, you know, I got hired by guys who were not the ideal for me, physical type or, you know, whatever. And so I kind of had to learn to look at men in a very different way in order to be able to perform. But not just like you couldn't walk in a door and just act, hey, man, how's it going? Like, that wasn't me. I would go in and I'd try to, like, if there wasn't going to be some kind of a real connection, I don't think I could have done it for as long as I did it. I really enjoyed getting to know people, and I enjoyed, and sometimes it wasn't a lot of chatting. Sometimes it was just getting down to sex. But even that, you know, you establish a connection in a certain way. But a lot of times it was guys who, like, they were lonely or, you know, they hadn't dated or somebody died recently and they wanted some comfort. I mean, I didn't take any of it for granted. And I learned a lot about men doing this job. And I think it changed me in a very, very good way.
How was that? You know, like, what was the change?
Well, it brought out my caretaking. It made me less judgmental of people. You know, when you're that close to somebody physically, you know, when you're standing away from somebody and you're not interested in them, it's very easy to kind of go like, ugh, where'd you get that shirt? You know, when you're feeling like an asshole. And again, this was back then. But to be in a room with them, to have a drink with them, to talk about their day, to then get naked with them, to then get intimate with them, you know, you kind of can't be judgmental in order to do that. You have to give that up. And I started to look at, like, he's funny or he's sweet or he's cute or his cock's 10 inches long or whatever it was that, you know, there was always something about everybody that appealed to me and made the work really great. I loved it. I fucking loved it.
Did you reach a point where you're ready to give it up?
Yeah. I did it. I quit it for a while in New York, as I mentioned, for that relationship. And then in LA, I kind of was like, I want to do it again. I wanted to. So I did it for a few years. And then, and at the time I was in my 40s, because I started late. Like, I worked for an escort service that was called Maturity Escorts.
Oh, wow.
And it was to hire older guys. And I was in my mid 30s at the time. So then I did it, you know, for a couple of years. And then I didn't do it. And then I did it again. I was in my 40s then. And at the time, which was like 2002 to 2005 or whatever, the whole idea of daddies was not a big thing. You were just old. So there were times when I would meet people in AOL chat rooms. And so there were times when we would start to connect and then they would say, well, how old are you? And I would put my age in my profile, but people don't really read them. And I would say, oh, I'm 42 or whatever. Click. Wouldn't hear from them again. So I thought, you know, this was fun and I'm really glad I did it. I learned a lot about myself. I made some good money and I really enjoyed it. But I had started personal organizing and that became something that I really loved. So as a way to make some money outside of showbiz, I kind of switched to that and thought, okay, I think my expiration date is up. You know, even though now You know, I'm 62 and I could still be an escort because there are guys who love older guys. But it was time for me to move on to something else. Not because I was embarrassed about it, not because I was ashamed of it, anything. No, it seemed like it was time.
Well, so you mentioned the erotic blogging. Like, when did that become a thing for you?
I have been a nude model from back 1989 when I posed for Tom Bianchi, the photographer Tom Bianchi. I was out in L.A. With the show, and I met him at the gym, and he asked if I wanted to pose. And at the time, I didn't. I was like, no, I'm going to be a TV star. I can't pose naked. Well, then the next year, I was walking down the beach at Fire Island, and there he was with a friend of mine. And my friend said, David, if you were ever going to do it, this is the guy to do it. So I did. So I posed for Tom at his house in Fire Island. Mm-hmm. And it became the shot became the last photo in his first book out of the studio. And I asked if it could be anonymous, you know, cut my head off, because I still wasn't comfortable with that. But then over the years, I started finding more photographers who wanted to work with me and who I wanted to work with. And I started to accrue this gallery of many, 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 many nude and erotic shots, sometimes telling a story, sometimes in context, sometimes just portraits. And I really didn't do anything with them. Sometimes the photographer would put it in an art book or in a gallery showing. But then I discovered in 2013, I discovered Tumblr, where people were posting in the book. I say everything from, like, you know, the meal you made last night to the dick you sucked last night. It's, you know, you could put anything there. And so I started to post, I like curated this gallery of my erotic work. And I started to get a lot of, because I kind of had a little bit of a name because of the gay independent films I had done. And because of the off-Broadway that I did, you know, like a minor gay celeb is what I kind of was. And so I attracted a lot of people to this who were like, well, look what he's doing now. So I kept that going until Tumblr purged adult material in 2018. And at the time, I started to film little kind of erotic videos with a filmmaker friend of mine, not thinking that we were ever going to do anything with them. But then I moved when Tumblr went, I went to OnlyFans. I started to post the same, you know, I put up all the photos I'd done, continued to post photos without charging a subscription because that's how I had done it on Tumblr. But then COVID came along and I thought, you know what? This is ridiculous. I'm going to start posting videos. I'm going to start charging a subscription and really attack this erotic exploration. And so March 2020 is when I went live with videos and it's been great. I have loved it. It, you know, financially, it's gotten me through the pandemic on top of, you know, it's not like I was destitute or anything, but it was nice to have that extra coming in. And it's a whole other way for me to be creative with my sexuality and my expression of sexuality. It's a part of me. It's never going away. And I could either have squelched it and said, oh, you shouldn't do that because what's it going to do to your career? Or I could go ahead and really explore. Still doing TV. I haven't done it, you know, since COVID, but the film of my one man show came out and I've got my book coming out. I still audition for stuff. So,
yeah, I think there might be this idea that a lot of folks might have that you have to choose one or the other. You can do like adult media or you can do, you know, in quotation marks here, legit. But
for a long time, that's how it was. If you crossed over, I say with quotes, then you weren't, you know, you were throwing your career away. And I always thought that that was ridiculous because people, porn stars, people having sex, people photographed naked, whatever. You have that too, sir, ma'am. You know, you have sex, you have a naked body. Why is it so fucking polarizing to see that? And why would you judge that and say, well, because he did that, we can't hire him? I just don't understand that at all. I think it's so hip. There's so much hypocrisy attached to that attitude about nudity and sexuality. And so that's part of why I've started to push my agenda even more. There's a whole lot of this in the book, which I think, you know, if anybody at all is angry about that kind of thing, then come on over to my side and we'll talk. But it's also funny to me. I mean, it's not just a book about my theater career and my hooking career and the bad relationship. And it's also about, like, it's my story told through the lens of body shame and sexuality. And it has led me places that I never thought I would go in my life, that I never thought I'd have the guts to go in my life, posting photos and, mm-hmm. you know, doing videos. And but I do it my way, with a little bit more of an artistic bent, you know, if I can. But sometimes I'm just shoving my dick in your face. Sometimes, you know.
Sure.
And I think it's – and I get a lot of people who are like, you know, especially guys my age, who are like, thanks for doing that. Because, you know, I get a sense. Yeah, there's just so many times when I think people after 40 start to feel sexually irrelevant. You know, that they think, well, I'm done. I'm going to cut it off and send it home because I'm not using it anymore. But the fact is that there is something for everybody. This is what I've learned. Tumblr blogs where guys in their 70s post photos and they get like hundreds of likes. Nobody is sexually irrelevant. It's all about confidence and doing what you want to do. And yeah, it's not an ideal world where if you're a corporate CEO and there's a picture that comes up of you sucking somebody's cock, will that be a problem? It might be for your business. It might be like some kind of a clause that you're not allowed to do it. In my mind, though, who fucking cares? Who cares? It shouldn't be ruinous. So hope, you know, we have progressed. But having said that, I still see the boys in or the guys in the locker rooms who have their underwear on. They put a towel around their waist and then take their underwear off. There is still that body shame. There is still that fear of nudity that it hurts my heart that something that is so sexuality that is so intrinsic to our beings causes people so much shame.
So if folks want to check out your book or connect with you online, see what else you're up to, where should they go to find you?
Well, the book is available for pre-order. It comes out in January. It's available for pre-order at either Amazon or penguinrandomhouse.com, I believe. Yeah, that comes out in January, but you can't pre-order. My OnlyFans is OnlyFans/RealGuyLA, R-E-A-L-G-Y-L-A. Mm-hmm. I'm on Twitter, both as RealGuyLA and David Pevsner. I'm on Instagram as dpevs. And I always say, if you are somebody who's like in the closet or scared or, you know, ashamed of their body, whatever, talk to me. You know, if you don't have anybody to talk to, send me a message, because I get messages from guys all the time about this kind of thing. And it just hurts my heart that people still feel this way. So I'm trying to do what I can. I hope that the book really starts that conversation, even though I have been chatting like a racehorse today. I can tell. Should have learned more for your questions. It's important to me. It's a very important issue for me.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for popping by and chatting about it, David. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Matt. I really appreciate it as well.
Thanks to David for joining me, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for the Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissants.